You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on Irritable Bowel Syndrome, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Lynn Chang. Dr. Chang is the co-director of the G. Oppenheimer Center for Neurobiology of Stress and Resilience and vice chief of the Vache and Tamara Manoukian Division of Digestive Diseases at UCLA. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for U.S. healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Lynn Chang, and welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on IBS. Today, we'll be discussing brain-gut behavior research and treatment in IBS with Dr. Lori Kiefer. Dr. Kiefer is an academic health psychologist and the director of psychobehavioral research within the Division of Gastroenterology at Mount Sinai. Welcome to In Discussion. Thank you, Lori, for being with us here today. We're very excited for this session. It's really important, and you are the leading expert on this. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Always happy to talk about brain-gut behavior therapies and to you, Lynn.
Thank you. Okay, I want to start off just asking you, and I know your story, but I think our listeners would like to know, how did you become interested in IBS?
Oh, that's a great question. So yeah, I think I've told some people kind of accidentally. I actually started out in graduate school. My mentor assigned me, without really me knowing anything about it, assigned me a study to teach people living with IBS, Herbert Benson's meditation. And I initially thought, I don't know, am I going to get stuck studying the bowels forever? I'm so embarrassed. How am I going to tell people that this is my job as a psychologist? But then the study was so interesting. I met these amazing patients. They learned how to meditate. And then the most fascinating part was that their symptoms improved. And from that point on, I was really hooked on these mind-body brain-gut interventions. I think I never really looked back after finding out that you could actually modify the GI tract using your brain.
Yeah, that's really amazing. It's interesting that you said that you were concerned at the beginning because of the stigma of studying the bowel, and it's something a lot of our patients experience, so you can understand that and help them through that aspect.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So psychological conditions can coexist with IBS. Can you describe the different conditions that commonly overlap with IBS and the prevalence of these conditions in patients with IBS?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, it's funny because we used to think of IBS as very psychosomatic, almost as if it was its own psychological disorder, right? And luckily, we've moved way past that and have found that in most cases, the most common psychological problems like depression, generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, really kind of stem from the experience of these chronic conditions, right? If you think about how unpredictable having IBS is, not knowing when you're going to be in pain, not knowing where the bathroom is, of course you have anxiety, right? Of course, if you can't get out and do the things you want to do, see the people you want to see, do this, eat the foods you want to eat, of course depression is going to come into play. So I think that there's one bucket of reactive psychological distress from having the condition, that's anxiety and depression. But anxiety and depression are also risk factors for the onset of these disorders. And I think we know more and more now that that's probably related to a lot of shared, both genetic and microbiome and brain gut vagus nerve pathways too. So I think, you know, 40 to 60% of people living with IBS do end up having some kind of anxiety or depressive most commonly. Certainly, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, it can also be kind of a common condition as well. This is why initially we thought that the behavior therapies worked was because we thought they helped with the psychological distress. But now we're really finding that there's sort of different targets for our brain-gut treatments.
I think a lot about how unpredictable these symptoms are. And I would say that's got to be one of the most challenging parts of having IBS is the unpredictability. And I think patients are always searching for, did I eat something bad? What happened? And it seems to be protective that they would have these fears or concerns or this symptom-related anxiety. It's really more protective, I find, which makes sense for them.
Yeah. And, you know, people, you get reinforced for avoiding things, right? So, I mean, this is how worry works too, right? If I always pack the extra 25, you know, outfits and, you know, deodorant and spray and wipes in my car, then that's the reason I don't have a bowel accident when I drive, right? And I've never challenged that because those things are in the car. And so therefore I'm safe. It's an insurance policy that we create for ourselves, right?
Yeah, I definitely think the word safe is really important. A lot of patients don't feel safe. And then they feel safe when they have treatments for their conditions or they know how to prevent them or at least minimize them. You know, so that's a really important feeling that I think to target for patients.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that psychological conditions can occur prior to developing IBS or these other disorders of gut-brain interaction, but the symptoms themselves of IBS can then trigger psychological responses and emotions. What is usually the scenario that you see?
I think I would say that I primarily see anxiety and depression in response to symptoms. I think a lot of patients will tell me, you know, I've always been a worrier. I'm always a little on the neurotic side. I'm type A personality. I'm a little perfectionistic, but I was never like this until I developed a health condition, right? And this could be partly because I'm a health psychologist, so that's how people enter my door. I'm not a regular psychologist in the community, but I do feel like people have certain traits and characteristics that are just part of their makeup that have worked really well for them in life. They're type A, they're perfectionist, great. You know, people love you at work. You're really reliable. But then you get this unpredictable, uncontrollable condition, and a lot of those behaviors and personality characteristics don't really fit. And that's where people start to feel anxious. They don't feel like themselves anymore.
Do you find that it's hard to alter what their regular MO is and the way that they function, but to approach it and think differently for their symptoms? Is that hard for people to do?
It's very hard. I mean, you and I have, I know we've always talked about that flexibility, right? It's that ability to sort of say, this works for me in this domain and over here in this part of my life, but it's not helpful for me to approach my GI tract like that, right? And I have to have that flexibility, knowing when a problem has a solution that I can go after it. And just work hard. Some people say, you know, I know that if I just work hard enough, I'm going to solve this problem. Well, it's not the case in IBS necessarily. And the strategies are being able to say, I can't solve this problem. I just need to keep myself comfortable, right?
Yeah. Okay. That's a great point. So how does the presence of having these psychological symptoms affect IBS symptom severity as well as quality of life?
So I always tell people stress, depression, anxiety might not have caused your symptoms, but they're certainly not helping you get over them. And I think that's where, you know, addressing anxiety in particular, symptom-specific anxiety, really make a huge difference in quality of life, right? Because if you are anxious about your symptoms and that unpredictability, and you're not able to be as flexible anymore in coping, then you're going to start to avoid things. You're going to start to feel less confident. You're not going to have that self-confidence in your ability to do things. It's going to reinforce your feelings of shame, the feelings of restriction and deprivation. And that's the vicious, vicious cycle around why certain people have such impaired quality of life is often because of their response to these symptoms being avoidance.
You know, you mentioned stress, and I believe stress is very important in IBS. I've been studying it for a long time. You have too. And stress can be good. You know, in a way, it makes us more efficient, but there's that fine line that if you have too much stress, that you go down the other side of the hill. You know, and so I do think that patients often have a struggle a little bit with saying that stress worsens their symptoms or that they got the symptoms due to being stressed. It's almost like considered a weakness. So what do you say to those patients who may feel that way?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I do feel that, again, going back, it's sort of that avoidance of, I just can't get myself stressed out. I'm not going to worry about, you know, I'm in New York City, I'm not going to take the subway, I'm going to take an Uber because I don't want the stress, right? Stress is just going to make it worse for me. But what that does is when you're afraid of stress, you just keep whittling away at your confidence and your sense of purpose and meaning, right? We thrive off of stress, and stress can be both, you know, positive and negative at the same time. And so I do really try to encourage people that stress, you know, stress is a part of life. I think what we want to do is keep it from affecting you physically, right? Stress used to be something, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, stress was something that turned on our fight or flight system. It was what kept us away from the saber-toothed tiger coming down the mountain. Those alarm signals were literally kept us alive. We don't have to do that anymore. Our bodies can have stress. We can have mental stress and not mount that full fight or flight response. So I think for a lot of patients, I really try to separate out the, you can go after your stress, be as stressed as you normally would be. Let's just try to protect you from having that full on fight or flight physiological response to stress. And that's resilience too, right? It's the homeostasis. How quickly do you recover after a stressful event physically?
Yeah, you brought up a good point of thinking that you have to get out of the mind frame of acute stress versus how you manage chronic stress. Because definitely getting chased by a saber-toothed tiger would be an acute stressor. And then you go into the survival mode. But if you have chronic stress and you learn to manage it, you're basically saying you don't have to go in this survival mode to an extreme. You can learn to manage it differently.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a great point. So what is your general approach in identifying psychological symptoms in patients with IBS? And also, as you being an expert, but also just the general healthcare community, how is it best to identify psychological symptoms if they're ones that they should refer or address from a management standpoint?
And that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I think that if you're treating GI disorders, particularly IBS, I think that you really have to include an emotional assessment, right? And again, it's not even just, check the box. Do you have depression? Do you have anxiety? Okay, refer to Dr. Kiefer. I think it's more of how are you coping with what you have, right? And what is the impact of your symptoms on your life? You know, just starting that conversation and then, you know, allowing the patient to sort of talk about it from that perspective. Because I think when you talk to patients, they're so afraid of being told that it's in their head or that it's psychiatric that they're not going to admit, if you will, or tell their doctors about anxiety and depression, even if it was present, right? Because they're afraid they're going to be told that that must be the cause of it. And so I think it helps to just sort of really ask patients, how are you coping? How are you managing emotionally? And then on the provider side, start to listen for some of those mechanisms that we target, right? Listen for things like pain catastrophizing. Listen for words like, I can't do this anymore, helplessness, depression. Listen for avoidance. When you hear someone describe how they cope with their symptoms, you can absolutely pick up on all of those things, even if you're not a psychologist. I think physicians feel that they have to make a diagnosis, right, in order to treat. So they have to meet criteria for depression in order to treat depression, or meet criteria for an anxiety disorder to treat anxiety. I think in IBS, though, we've moved past that. And it's really more about just listening for those interpretations of symptoms that could potentially exacerbate those symptoms. That's how you can get the hook in to refer.
Yeah, that's such a great point, because I was thinking about labels. Like you're using the word diagnosis. But we often think of labels. It's like a checklist. Do you have anxiety? Do you have stress? Do you have depression? Rather than asking, how are your symptoms affecting your life? How are you managing them? And really coming more from a narrative standpoint rather than a checklist label diagnosis standpoint. That would work much better in the communication with the patient.
Absolutely. Yeah. And most patients, you know, I think are very comfortable answering that question. They've certainly thought about how they're coping and how they're managing. I think that a lot of times providers tell me, like, I don't want to pry. I don't want to open Pandora's box. They came here because I'm a gastroenterologist. I don't want to ask them about these things. So they default to what they know, which is the checkboxes, right? But I it's very rare that you ask a patient how they're coping with something emotionally and they talk at you for more than a minute. Usually it's very quick. They explain they're not doing well. They're anxious. They're avoiding food. They're afraid to go on vacation. Okay, great. Got it. I have someone for you.
Right. Yes, that's good. Because I totally agree with you. When I see patients, I still remember a GI fellow said, I didn't ask about anything psychological because I knew you're going to ask. I didn't want to go down that path. Like they're worried that it's going to go like this rabbit hole and then they're not sure how to get out of it. But I think the way that you're saying asking it without any diagnosis or label, just how are they doing, is really but more about what's important. And it's important to them.
Right. What are their goals, you know? And you can, it's a way in, right? You may not be able to take away your IBS, but I think we could get you to feel more comfortable the day of your daughter's wedding. Right? Right.
That's practical.
Practical, right? Yeah. That's what you want, right?
That's what they want. Yeah. That's really important. Okay. Now, there are a lot of brain gut behavior therapies, and a lot of it has to do with a lot of the work you've done. Gut-directed hypnotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. What is the evidence that these therapies are effective in IBS, and how do you choose which one you would recommend to a patient?
That's great. So they are both considered sort of evidence-based brain gut behavior therapies. To be called a brain gut behavior therapy these days, you have to be able to show that the intervention actually reduced the core symptoms of IBS, meaning abdominal pain in particular, and to some degree improved satisfaction with bowel movements. So this cognitive behavior therapy for GI disorders and hypnosis, gut-directed hypnotherapy, have both been shown in trials, randomized control trials, large-scale audits, meta-analyses, sort of a high-level evidence to move the needle on abdominal pain and satisfaction with bowel habits. So I think that's the first sort of talking point for patients, that there is evidence for these to actually affect GI symptoms, just like a medication, right? We're apples to apples. We're altering GI symptoms. So that makes them both really good options. And sometimes I combine the two, right? Sometimes I'll start with hypnosis and then we'll move into CBT. Sometimes I'll start with CBT, move into hypno. I think that for a lot of patients, it's around their preference, what they were kind of expecting. I think it's also around the target. So the other nice thing about our brain gut behavior therapies is that they target different aspects of that gut brain dysregulation, right? So cognitive behavior therapy is going to be much more targeting some of those cognitive and emotional arousal centers in the brain that patients experience when they have pain, right? That, oh no, here we go again. What if I have a bowel accident? I can't handle this. There's self-talk there that is amplifying their symptoms. So when they have that as a primary way that they're sort of talking to themselves, cognitive behavior therapy can often be your best bet, right? Because you can actually, okay, let's write down your thoughts. Let's challenge those. Let's see if we can, you know, as we say, catch, challenge, change the thoughts. Some people don't have that. They don't have the catastrophic thoughts, or they don't have access to that, or they just tell you, I feel this. Like I just have these feelings, or I also have sleep problems and I have low back problems and I have, you know, these other symptoms, but none of them are really tied to the way I'm thinking. I think then hypnosis often can be helpful, because then we're going to the subconscious. We're saying, let's get your brain and gut communicating again. Let's sort of put into when you're not really fully alert, let's put in some suggestions to reset that brain gut pathway. So it really kind of, like, if the patient, it's going to depend on how they're describing their coping with their symptoms and which target we want to go after. Do we want to go after that brain emotion? do we want to go after that visceral, physical arousal?
You have such a nice way of explaining it to patients, you know, and that's so important. Because it's not really getting them on the defense. It's explaining it in a very calm, very nice way, you know, with not being too wordy. I think that communication is so important.
Right. And I mean, these interventions are, you know, because they're not a pill, they do require full cooperation. You know, we only know what the patient tells us. We're only able to intervene upon the things that they share. And so it really has to be a mutual collaborative experience. Our mechanism of action starts with the relationship. And then from there, there's a lot you can do as a therapist, right? I can get somebody to go on a subway without wearing Depends, for example, because they trust me and they think I told them they can do it, right? There is that relationship, that sense of collaboration, that sense of experimentation. Let's test things out. Let's be scientific together about your particular case.
So it takes a lot of active listening, really listening to the patient, which you say to them that will then resonate with them, and also, you know, working together as a team, as partnership. I want to move on to resilience, and you mentioned resilience, and people use that term a lot, and it may mean different things to different people, and you've really targeted for inflammatory bowel disease and now IBS as well, and I find that very important. Can you define resilience and also its importance as a therapeutic target in IBS?
Yeah. So, you know, resilience is really about adaptation, right? Resilience, you know, we used to use the word resilience when we talked about building bridges. Engineers talked about that, right? You need a resilient bridge that can like hold up a structure, but flex with the wind or the water underneath it, right? That is resilience. And you know, as a resilience researcher yourself, that, you know, it's really about the body and mind's ability to adapt. So physiologically, we need to be able to adapt, restore our bodies back to homeostasis, modulate our stress response, you know, recover from injury. And we need to be able to psychologically adapt to challenges, see them as, you know, opportunities rather than crises. And these are all learned characteristics. We're all resilient. We actually know if you did nothing to people in terms of resilience over time, people become more resilient because bad things happen to people over time. And every time you have a bad thing happen, you have to adjust, right? We're always doing that. The problem is for a lot of us, when we develop a chronic condition like IBS, right, we have to adjust or adapt to a health situation earlier in life than maybe our peers, or we have to do it in a louder way because it's more noticeable. It's different. And so that's where these resilience building tools can be really helpful, right? Because we're saying you have it within you. We're just going to help you identify those strengths and use them now for your health. We're going to help you. We're just going to speed up the bounce back. And actually, I often tell patients, I don't even want you to just bounce back. I want you to bounce forward. I want you to actually be a better person because of this experience, right? Like, I actually think you can achieve more now because this happened to you. And now you had to pay attention to your lifestyle. You had to get rid of the toxic people in your life. You had to, you know, you had to maybe change your career to something that you were better suited for. That's an adaptation. That's resilience. That's a good thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm sure they are not used to somebody saying, not just bounce back, I want you to bounce forward. They probably not even thinking that I could achieve that goal by doing this.
Unfortunately, a lot of our patients settle, right? They settle for these, you know, not feeling well, and they settle. I mean, so many people come in and just say, I just don't feel good every day. I mean, some days are better than others, but I don't ever really just feel good.
Right. Okay,
so that's not acceptable, right?
We're running out of time here. And this is, I mean, I could talk to you forever on this topic, really. Yeah, I want to end with just, what are the key messages regarding IBS, psychological disorders, brain gut behavior therapies that you think are really important, maybe didn't touch on, that you want to communicate to the audience?
I think that the future is really bright in terms of brain gut behavior therapies. I think we've gotten more and more rigorous in our approach to them. I think we have targeted the mechanisms through which they work in ways that we didn't. We used to throw the kitchen sink at patients, and we had to sort of see them over months and months of therapy to provide these services. And now we really, thanks to brain imaging work, thanks to microbiome work, we really, I think the future is bright in these, and that we're able to really personalize our approach to care now instead of just throwing things at patients. So I think that's one really positive change in the field that I think we're going to continue to see going forward. I think the other exciting thing is that there are more and more of us trained in GI psych. You know, when I started 20 years ago in Ned Blanchard's lab, right, there that wasn't a profession. And now we have people all the time coming in and saying, I want to learn these techniques and really kind of build it out. I think the other big, you know, interesting, maybe not main talking point, but interesting is the use of digital technology, how we can start to maybe address some of these mechanisms more proactively rather than waiting for somebody to get to your or my office before we intervene, right? Before the disability sets in, before the depression sets in, before the anxiety sets in. So I think that's the other big positive aspect of brain gut behavior therapies and IBS treatment. I mean, I think that we've really made a huge progress in the last, you know, couple decades.
Yeah, those are good points. If there is a need, it'll grow, right? If something will happen, if there really is a need, and there is a need, and that's why it's growing. So thank you so much, Lori, for joining us today. We've had Dr. Kiefer discussing the association of psychological factors in IBS, their importance in symptoms, severity, quality of life, and treatment. And really important to know that brain gut behavior therapies can reduce gastrointestinal symptoms, not just mood and psychological symptoms, and that there are many future therapeutic options that they'll have. And this is a really growing field. And as they say, it's just the start. So this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Lynn Chang for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Irritable Bowel Syndrome podcast series with our host, Dr. Lynn Chang. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on irritable bowel syndrome.